30 years ago this month, John Hinckley Jr. shot President Ronald Reagan outside the Hilton Hotel in Washington. Journalist Del Wilbur has written a book that redefines what we know about that day. It's called Rawhide Down. Rawhide was President Reagan's Secret Service code name. One of the dozens of people Wilbur interviewed for his book was Jerry Parr, the lead Secret Service agent that day. Parr and Wilbur joined us in the studio, and Del Wilbur began by describing the moment the shots were fired.
2:27 p.m., March 30th, 1981. Reagan leaves the VIP entrance of the Washington Hilton. He walks towards his limousine. He has to walk about 25 feet in public. That's when John Hinckley, in the crowd, 15 feet from the president, unleashes a full slot of bullets. Three other men go down. Jerry Parr grabs Reagan after hearing the first two shots, shoves him into the limousine. They land in a pile in the limousine. Jerry lifts him up in the limousine. They're taken off. They're getting out of there really fast.
The president arrived at George Washington Hospital just 4 minutes after he was shot. But, Del, your book reveals that the limousine did not immediately set out for the hospital. Let's listen to a cut of tape that we're hearing publicly for the first time today.
Rawhide is okay. Follow up. Rawhide is okay. You want to go to the hospital or back to the White House?
We're going to Crown.
Back to the White House. Rawhide is okay.
That's tape from inside the presidential limousine. Del, explain why the limousine was not going straight to the hospital.
Well, no one knows Reagan's been shot. Jerry doesn't know. As he's checking Reagan, he runs his hands up and down Reagan. He realizes, wait a minute, you know, there's no blood in my hands. The president seems okay. We better get back to the most secure place in the world, the White House.
But, Jerry, you made a fateful decision on the way to the White House. Let's hear the tape in which you decide not to go to the White House after all.
Roger, we want to go to the emergency room of George Washington. Go to George Washington fast.
Roger. That's the voice of the limousine driver responding to Agent Jerry Parr's decision not to go to the White House. Jerry, what made you change course?
What made me change the course, Ari, is that there was a profuse amount of blood coming out of his mouth. So I looked at that, and I thought, well, maybe I broke a rib when I came down on top of him. And so I talked to the president. I said, I'm taking you to the hospital. And he basically agreed with me. Either he said okay or he nodded. We didn't say very much after I decided to go to the hospital. I took a chance that day. But Dr. Ruge, he said, if you'd have gone to the White House first and then come back, he'd have been close to dying.
So the limousine arrives at GW Hospital. President Reagan notably walks himself into the emergency room, lending to the narrative that he wasn't badly hurt.
Reagan hitches up his pants. You know, he walks in, gets in about 20, 30 feet. He collapses like a stone. Jerry and another agent grab him. They carry him off to the trauma bay. His eyes had rolled back in the head. Nurses, doctors, and paramedics who were there thought he was going to die. He looked that bad. But they treated him first. They jacked him full of fluids. They got his blood pressure going, getting up. They did all that stuff, and that stabilized him, kept him from going too far into shock, and that's what saved his life.
Agent Jerry Parr, you were by the president's side.
Yes.
At what point did you realize that this was a very serious situation?
When we got him to that room, they stripped his clothes off very fast. I thought for a moment there, maybe 1 or 2 minutes, that we might lose him, because I was conscious and awake and alert and an agent in New York City when Kennedy was still living. So I went through that whole scene with the Kennedy assassination 18 years previous. Those kind of scenes stuck in my mind forever, and I never wanted it to happen to me. Unfortunately, it did happen to me.
And President Reagan had this famous line before he went under for surgery.
Yes, actually, after he regained consciousness, I was standing pretty close to his head, and he had an oxygen mask on, but I could hear him. And that's when he looked up, and he looked all around as far as he could. He said, "Jerry, I hope they're all Republicans." We all smiled, but we were under a lot of stress, and I didn't, you know, burst out laughing. But then he did it again before he went under his anesthesia. He said, "I hope they're all Republicans." And that's when I think Dr. Giordano said, "Well, today we're all Republicans."
So this non-fatal assassination attempt, we now know, came literally within 1 inch of piercing President Reagan's heart.
Or even the aorta, or another huge artery. When the surgeon was hunting for the bullet, he was terrified. It had slipped and gotten into an artery that could have gone to his brain. It was that close.
The surgeons did not easily find the bullet to remove it, and in fact considered leaving it in the president's body.
Well, often these in these injuries, you do leave bullets in bodies because they're benign. They don't go anywhere. In this case, the surgeon had two implications. One, he didn't want it migrating somewhere else. That could cause trouble. And two, he envisioned, as he's hunting for this bullet, he's about to give up. He's like, maybe I'll just leave. I can't find it. He's squishing around in the lung, and it's like kind of moving around with his fingers. He can't find it. He goes,
now, when you say squishing around, he is literally holding the President of the United States' lung in his hand, trying to find the bullet.
Manipulating it with his fingers. And another, which is crazy, a 31-year-old surgical intern reaches his hand in and cups the beating president's heart in his hand and pulls it aside so he could work and get more room in there. And so as he's looking for this bullet, they have to get it. And Ben Aaron's thinking, God, I can envision the New York Daily News headline tomorrow, doctor leaves bullet in president. I cannot have that happen.
Jerry, it's pretty clear that you saved the president's life more than once that day. At the same time, this book reflects a sense that in some ways the Secret Service may have failed by letting John Hinckley get too close to the president. So how do you file this event in your mind?
Before that event, the Secret Service took a position of more like a defensive posture. But with this event, we realized it can't work anymore. And we did it in a flash. That's what came out of it. Yes, it could have been done better. And I was the boss, so I always took the blame for it. But I also will take blame for the successes.
Now, Della, there is so much detail in the hospital scene, for example. You write, the tiled floors and walls, which gave off a faint odor of disinfectant, echoed with the din of hospital chatter. How do you get that kind of sensory recreation of that moment 3 decades ago?
Well, I interviewed a lot of people, you know, more than 125. And I think that's what did it, just interviewing and interviewing and interviewing. Also, I really benefited from some doctors and nurses as they went home and took these wonderful notes down, wrote diary entries, even spoke into tape recorders. One nurse I interviewed at the very end of my process had a wonderful Reagan story. You know, Reagan's recovering the next day. You know, he survives. He's in the recovery room all night. And so his aides come in, and the aides say, well, Mr. President, just want to let you know that the guy who did it, it's crazy, but he's from a good family. And Reagan goes, well, I was kind of hoping to be the KGB. And there's a pause, and Reagan says, nah, I don't think so. He wouldn't have missed then. And a nurse, a Marine McCann, now Marine O'Brien, she went home and jotted that whole thing down, that whole day for her. It was historic. I also really benefited from this guy, Jerry Parr, who happens to have the best memory of this day of anyone.
Well, Jerry, do you remember every day of your life this clearly, or was this an extraordinary moment?
It's such an extraordinary moment.
Even so, it's
not every day you say the life of a president, I suppose.
That's true.
Del Wilber, Jerry Parr, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Jerry Parr is a retired Secret Service agent. And journalist Del Wilber's new book is called Rawhide Down, The Near Assassination of Ronald Reagan. It goes on sale Tuesday.
Big news in the bond market. PIMCO, the world's biggest bond investor, has sold off all the U.S. government-related holdings in its biggest mutual fund. That is the PIMCO Total Return Fund. It holds over $200 billion in securities. As recently as January, 12% of that was in U.S. government holdings, and now it's evidently down to zero. Bill Gross, who founded PIMCO, joins us now from Newport Beach, California. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very
much. Once again, and in a nutshell, why? Why sell off all that federal debt?
Treasury bonds, basically as a group, yield about 2%, and it simply seems to us at PIMCO that based upon expectations for inflation and for the real economy going forward, that a 2% reward is not appropriate relative to the risk being taken.
There was just a bond auction I saw, and the Treasury sold $21 billion in 10-year notes for what I gather was a good price, over 3%. Are you going against the grain here, or do you think you're out in front of a trend? Which would you say?
Well, it seems like it for the last few days. You're very observant. Yesterday, the 10-year auction did go very well at 3.5%. So obviously somebody wants them. Having said that, you know, a contrarian investor, at times at least, is rewarded for their contrarianness. And so we'll stick to it at least for a while.
There have been many Cassandras recently saying that the Treasury sometime in the future may have real trouble finding people to continue lending to us. Right now, you're not going to do that. Do you believe there's going to come a time when everyone will make the same judgment you're making? It's not worth lending to the United States of America anymore.
Well, everyone won't make the judgment at the same time, but there certainly are problems that the Treasury have. They have a debt ceiling deadline in the next few weeks that may or may not be broached, and they have increasing levels of debt to GDP, which place them in the category of a double-A type of nation moving towards single-A.
So you're describing risks there. You're describing doubts that you have about Treasury paper.
Well, I think so. The doubt's primarily that a 2% average yield for Treasury debt is far below historical comparisons, and that an investor, a bond investor, should look to corporate debt or to other countries which offer higher interest rates.
Which raises the question, if your mutual fund has moved $25 billion out of U.S. government related holdings, where's it going?
To a number of areas. To corporate debt, municipal debt to some extent. Yields there are very attractive at 6.5% to 7%, not without some risk. And we've moved into other countries, Mexico, Brazil. You know, even countries such as Italy offer premiums relative to U.S. Treasury that are historic in comparison.
If the Federal Reserve's practice of quantitative easing, the QE2, as they
yes.
say, if it ends in a couple of months or at the end of June, what would you expect to happen next? Would you expect to start seeing substantially higher yields on federal bills, and would you be back into U.S. government-held debt at that time?
Sure. Of course, if it's a question of the interest rate, and if interest rates went up, which would be my expectation, then certainly we've got nothing against Treasury debt other than the yield that they offer. Up until this point, the Federal Reserve has been the primary buyer of these Treasury auctions to the tune of $1.5 trillion. Basically, the Fed has been matching the U.S. deficit, one hand feeding the other. When they disappear, or if they disappear at the end of June, then, you know, that does call into question who's going to fill the hole, and I suspect the hole has to be filled with, yes, the PIMCOs of the world and foreign buyers, but buyers that are attracted by a higher interest rate as opposed to a current interest rate.
Mr. Gross, thank you very much for talking with us today.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
It's Bill Gross of PIMCO speaking to us from Newport Beach, California. PIMCO, which operates the world's largest mutual fund, has gotten rid of all of the U.S. government-related holdings in it. It used to be 12% of the fund as recently as January. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Before a novelist can really write about the world, she has to have seen a bit of it. And Teja Obret certainly has. She was born in the former Yugoslavia. She spent her childhood in Cyprus and Egypt and then emigrated to the United States, all by the age of 12. Now, 26, Obret is about to publish her first novel, and our reviewer, Alan Chews, is as enthusiastic as he can be about a literary debut.
Natalia Stefanovi, the narrator of this stunning first novel, is a young doctor who, in the period just after the latest round of Balkan wars, sets off to a remote seaside town to immunize children in need. Her grandfather inspired her to become a physician. His death, while on a mysterious visit to the village of his World War II childhood, inspires young Natalia to gather up the fragments of his life. Obret writes with an angel's pen about this, creating a skein of descriptive passages plush with apt details and ringing with lyrical diction about city life, country life, private dreams and public difficulties, and about the way the past and present come together in a complex and seething whole. Here's her recounting of the astonishing life of the tiger of the title, who during her grandfather's childhood escapes from a city zoo during a World War II German bombing raid and treads its way through the urban streets and then up into the hilly countryside, where it ultimately becomes the companion of a lonely, battered, deaf-mute wife. Up on one of the ridges, Obret writes, with its bowed saplings and deadfall underfoot, the steep flank of the mountain studded with caves, the wild game wide-eyed and reckless with the starvation of winter, trapped the tiger between his new broadening senses and the vaguely familiar smell of the village below, the thick woolly smell of sheep and goats, the smell of fire, tar, wax, the interesting reek of the outhouses, paper, iron, the individual smells of people. the savory smells of stew and goulash, the grease of baking pies. And some nights later, there was a new smell. He had sensed it here and there in the past, the momentary aroma of salt and wood smoke rich with blood. As the tiger senses it, that's the smell of life, and this novel reeks of it.
Taya Obrett's debut novel is called The Tiger's Wife. Our reviewer, Alan Chews, teaches writing at George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia.
That earthquake is being described as the strongest one ever recorded in Japan's history. It struck offshore to the east of Japan, about 80 miles from the northern coastal city of Sendai. It appears that most of the damage was caused not by the ground shaking, but by the tsunami it generated, which earlier this morning reached Hawaii and is still moving across the Pacific. Joining us to talk about all of this is NPR science correspondent Richard Harris. Good morning.
Hi, Renee.
A magnitude 8.9, of course, huge quake. What kind of damage can a quake that size cause?
Well, Japan was lucky, at least in terms of shaking, because this was far off the coast. And by the time the shaking came inland, it was very widespread, felt for hundreds of miles. Tokyo is 230 miles away from the epicenter of this quake, but it's felt over a very wide area of Japan. But according to the shaking maps that I looked at, there was no place where it was absolutely severe shaking, the kind of shaking that did so much damage in Haiti and so on. So the shaking part of this quake, despite its size, wasn't that big. It wasn't as bad as it could have been because of its distance offshore. The real issue appears to be the tsunami, which washed ashore rather rapidly. We don't know exactly how high it was. We've seen suggestions that it could be 10, 20, 30 feet tall, a very, very substantial wave coming ashore and doing great damage just by itself, the water.
And the tsunami waves are not only big and lots of water, but it's also a very powerful movement. And it appears in the city of Sendai, we're seeing more and more pictures, videos coming out. Looks like it just carried away, you know, buildings and cars and various things. The death toll is in the hundreds in those areas hard hit by the tsunami. So I'm wondering how it compares to the 2004 Indian Ocean tsunami that killed hundreds of thousands.
Right. And in terms of magnitude, this quake was a little bit smaller than that earthquake. But the major difference was that the earthquake that struck the Indian Ocean in 2004, the fault that broke over a stretch of 900 miles. And so there was a tremendous amount of movement of the earth under the ocean and a tremendous amount of movement of the water. So even though this was a very large earthquake, there's no indication right now that it was anything like that huge, huge earthquake that left so much water flowing out. So clearly water's moving. There's enough here to create a tsunami that we've been tracking all morning across the Pacific, but it does not appear that it's going to cause anything like the kind of damage that the Sumatra earthquake did.
And Lucy, we just heard mentioned damage to Japan's industrial base. I gather that base includes nuclear power plants. And what is the worry there?
Well, most of them just shut down safely, which is what they're supposed to do in an earthquake. But apparently one of them lost cooling water. And that led Japanese authorities to declare a state of emergency there, because you need to make sure that the core stays cool. Otherwise, you could have a more significant, a serious accident there. Right now, the Japanese authorities say no radiation has escaped, but they've evacuated some area around it as a priority. We're keeping a close eye on that.
And the tsunami has already hit Hawaii in the middle of the night in Hawaii, early in 3, 4 in the morning, still dark. What do we know about that?
Well, the first waves that came through were between 3 and 6 feet tall, not that big a deal, although they aren't just like breakers on the beach. These are actually waves. These can be piles of water that come in at that height. So saying a 6-foot tsunami is not at all like a 6-foot wave you might want to go surfing on. But that said, Hawaii did not report any significant damage. They are still waiting it out, because the first wave is not necessarily the worst one, and the all clear has not yet been sounded in Hawaii. But it appears like this was not a huge problem there.
Which is good news for the coastlines of the USA and Central and South America, because this tsunami is headed that way too.
Right. And in fact, it should be arriving on the Pacific coast even as we speak right now. And They have put up tsunami warnings for Oregon and California. They've warned for Alaska and also some warnings and also some advisories saying even if you're in like Washington State, don't go in the water because the water could be a lot of turmoil in the water. But the expectation is the average wave will be small, but local effects can have a big difference, and you can still generate big waves in small places. So it's prudent to get to high ground.
Richard, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
That's NPR's science correspondent, Richard Harris. And this is Morning Edition from NPR News.